issue, the media, basically, is what I'm getting at. You know, just the media and how bad it has become to a point where children in school even have to do media literacy classes. They're starting to do media literacy classes, and it's becoming a needed thing.
What is media literacy?
Well, I guess just when you go back, just when you look back when you're in school, right, and they tell you when you're looking up a source, you know, you need to be looking it up from not just Wikipedia, but you look it up from this site, you try and see it from multiple sites, or what, you know, for example, on the internet.
In high school, I remember them making us use scholarly websites.
Like, yeah, or stuff like that. But yeah, I guess media literacy just revolves around that, just good sourcing and how to source things, what to look for, but then also paying attention to how the framing of question is being made out to be, if that makes sense. So like the way a question is being asked, you know, and the different I can't remember, there's
a metric,
just the different fallacies that come from bad ways of making an argument, like a straw man argument, or like ad hominem argument.
Let's consider the motivation of the media in the first place, because most media sources are looking for viewership.
Yeah, and profits.
And the biggest thing that is going to garner viewership is, you know, outrage.
Yeah, emotional
yeah. material. What bleeds is what leads. Like, there's always this, like, trying to make a big bonfire out of a situation to get attention is definitely what I've seen the media turn into.
And that was another part of it too, being able to identify what elicits what emotion.
Should people even be wanting to get their information from public sources of media? I guess that kind of pushes like the extreme of that question. Well, because if we didn't look at any form of media, we wouldn't be getting any information, which I think some people do too. Like when it comes to like far conspiracy theorists, you have people who like completely disown any and all scientific evidence of anything, you know, and maybe they're only getting their information from one very, very specific source of what they trust, which could be very scary as well.
Echo chambers.
Yeah. Like, where do you get into a middle ground? How could we get healthy reporting for this first place? How could we have different motivations when it comes to what is reported and how it's reported?
Right. You know, it's hard to say, really, right? Because, you know, we can start by doing more independent medias that have less motives, you know, and are less, that just don't have specific motives, but actually just want to report on the facts, you know, whether that goes against their narrative that they lean to or not. But
have you ever listened to World News?
I do. I do Polish news. I do Indian news. Yeah.
You see a difference.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's a difference in how other countries report, or do you think
it's definitely
different?
Yeah. So the Supreme Court so many years ago ended up taking away a big staple of news here in America, where it used to be, you know, and this is back where there was only like three channels, right? And everyone watched it, and the news was not opinion based, but just based on the facts, or they were more or less required to both sides. Things, no matter what, you got to have the other side to this side, the other side to this side, and that the Supreme Court struck that down. I would have to look up which case it was, but that really opened the floodgates to opinion-based media, right? Mm-hmm. So people like Rachel Maddow of MSNBC or like Tucker Carlson on Fox News, and they get to just spout whatever they want to spout, with fact-based or not. You know?
What about footage in courtrooms, which I'm pretty hazy on the dates too, but I'm pretty sure that some of the first courtroom reporting was in the 70s and the 80s. Like O.J. Simpson, and I just happened to just listen to this like podcast on O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson's trial had so many views, it was 94 million views at peak viewership at one point.
Really?
Americans watching the trial. And at one point, it surpassed the NBA Finals at that time.
I wonder what the population was back then, because now it's like 330 million.
Probably 280, I bet you. Probably 270 or 280. I'm just a rough guesstimate here, folks. But, like, I would wonder how publicity in those sort of things, because imagine how many times people have had to switch courtrooms and even go to other different, like, they have to have their court in a different jurisdiction because of the simple
right.
fact that so many people know about what's going on already.
Yeah.
You know, like, is that good reporting, like, at all? Like, does that help the case? Does that help society in any way for anybody to be seeing these things?
I don't know. I guess that depends on what you think about the court of public opinion,
yeah.
though, right? Because that's a whole separate thing from, you know, legal court, but then the court of public opinion. You know, you can look at what happened with Johnny Depp and Amber Heard.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
I don't pay attention to anything at all, and I still heard about this because everybody was talking about this.
Everyone was. Yeah, you see all the different videos of the Amber Heard poo videos and stuff. That was crazy.
It's weird how ideas can spread in our society now. Like, and it's new. A lot of the stuff's new. Like, how it's evolved
right.
to this point.
Like, yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, a lot of them are, a lot of these new concepts, you know, I'm speaking to it too. Did I tell you too? I spoke down at the park over on Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was speaking to.
You can describe that if you want. If you want to put publicity to that event.
Oh yeah, just the we had the shooting on Saturday night of the Colorado Springs shooting where 5 people were killed, and the updated numbers, the reassessed numbers, were 25 injured.
Jesus Christ.
I watched this one interview, it was a local news station, it might have been Denver News, and they were in the hospital with this guy. He got shot 7 times, and a few of them were through, a few of them had to were like in there, they had to
so
dig
he was badly bullets. Badly injured,
and this was over a course of, like, they say less than a minute before he got taken down by the hero, Richard Fierro, and then there was another person that helped. It was a drag performer, and so they had heels on, and so they had,
that was
a big part of the thing where she came over and started slamming him in the face with the heels, and before she did that, he yelled to her, it's like, you know, kick the AR away, and then, you know, he, I guess, got a hold of his pistol and started beating him with it, and they got him, I don't know if you've seen the mugshot online, but they got him detained before the cops got there, that's for sure. And the cops got there about 3 minutes later, is what it's said to be. And,
from the beginning of the shooting?
Yeah, yeah. And then they actually, very sadly, they detained Richard Fierro because he was covered in blood, and he was in the car for about an hour trying to figure out what was happening to his family.
Well, that's horseshit.
Well, and it was his daughter's boyfriend since middle school, and they're like maybe early 20s or so, he was one of the people, one of the 5 that died, and so he wasn't even a part of the LGBTQ community. He was just they were there supporting a friend, a performer, and so they just happened to be there that night, and so he ended up losing his life. So it's really sad, but and so he's in court. He the guy, what is it, Lee Aldridge, something, that guy, the shooter, he's in court. He went to court on, I think it was Tuesday, and so I've been meaning to look it up. I have to...
They better ream him.
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, seriously. Well, and the sad thing is, too, as a really... they're trying to obscure the... what the reality... what many perceive to be the reality of the matter... by using a legal defense and saying that he identifies as non-binary himself. And so, which is just really...
Is that even, like, does it have anything to do with it?
I don't think so, if you ask me, I think it's just a legal defense. That's what the narrative is.
Death is death. Like killing people should be morally applicable despite anything, you know?
Yeah, like, and yeah, you're saying like, yeah, having like, to do with the killings themselves, yeah.
Like, he should still get reamed for what he did.
Right.
And does him being non-binary, does that mean that he couldn't have negative feelings about other people of other orientations? Like, I don't think that has any grounding either in logical basis. You know, like, you could be, you know, all right, let's pick a different thing. I'm white, and I could also not like another white person.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
or like something like that as well. Or I could have weird conflictions about my race, you know, or myself in it, you know, as well. Like, I don't think he should be given any softness by a long shot for sharing any sort of like identification with his victims, you know?
Right.
Does that make any sense?
No, yeah, like, definitely it does.
It's just a weird argument to pull up right on the front, and that's my gut feeling towards it.
I guess it just goes back to what we were talking about too, about the court of public opinion though, right? Where it doesn't and shouldn't have any basis legally, but in the court of public opinion, that's where they're trying to obscure it.
Well, OJ got away with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, he literally did. He paid his way out of that shit after killing two people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while since I watched some documentary about that on Netflix, but yeah, didn't he end up going on a civil case, though?
Yeah, he had to pay for the rest of his life. But he was still free. He never had to go to jail.
I thought he did. He didn't?
Nope. He just owed a ridiculous amount of money, so they sold all of his shit, which is kind of nice. Like, there's the family of the guy. So the guy who was living with his ex-wife and her family, they basically got to sell all of his stuff. And they sold like all of his sports memorabilia, his Heisman trophy, his house, his cars. And so he was definitely
even the trophy
pillaged. And I think at some point he did go to jail because he went and stole back one of his trophies out of a hotel room. And he got down for armed robbery because he used a pistol to do it.
Maybe that's what it was. I read somewhere that he had to go to jail for something.
Yeah, but he murdered two people. And that was like almost 16 years after that.
Right, yeah, I guess not for actually murdering people, but for right, armed robbery, huh?
I'm sorry, I've wandered a little bit far off of where we were going.
Oh,
okay, we're fine.
Yeah.
So let's generalize a little bit more about this situation. What do you think are the trigger points in society that are making these things happen? Because this isn't the only occasion of something like this happening. Like, this isn't the only state it's happening in either.
Right.
And I would hazard to say it's probably happening in other countries too. You know, like, I bet you this is probably a globalist trend when we think about how the Western, quote-unquote, world is doing.
And we're referring to media or shootings?
Well, violence. Public violence. I think that's also aligned with media and how it's being portrayed. I think this is kind of a mutual thing. Like, what are the other pinch points besides media that you think are making people snap? Yeah, that's not like the best word.
Right. No, yeah, I just I thought I'd ask which one specifically, because a thought popped in my head that when you're saying happening in other countries, that's actually the crazy thing, and not to get, I guess, political here about it, but there is evidence that, I mean, you could just look at the statistics, and I have a lot, and in other countries, even ones that have a lot of guns, they don't have mass shootings. We're the only country that has mass shootings like we do. And as of 2022, we have had 600, I think this was the 601st mass shooting that we had. And then the one, there's actually another one just 2 days after, a couple days ago in Idaho, and then I think in Virginia too. So we're up to like 603.
So what do you think is different about America?
I think,
politics, like, I feel like politically, like, we have this huge trend towards nationalism in a lot of countries.
Yeah.
Which is kind of part of this, like, attaboy culture, too.
Yeah. Well, and that's, depending on who you ask, you know, it's either the guns we have or the lack of regulation for guns. Maybe not necessarily. I would lean towards it's not, you know, we should still have guns, but there just should be more things in place.
Is there different education in other countries?
Yes, yes. So in places like New Zealand, and they have only had one mass shooting, and that was in like 2012 or something, or it might have been like 1999 or some years ago, some decades ago, a long time ago. And to own a gun, even if you have a gun, your granddad has a gun, he passes away and leaves it to you, you then have to go get it registered and then have to take some, like, over
mental
a course
health.
Of a month, like, classes, like, training classes. Like, you gotta do a weekend of classes for, like, 4 weekends straight, like, a month. And you actually have to be trained on it and also have it registered to where there's accountability. There's incentive not to, or, well, more incentive than we have to be responsible with it.
So are people inheriting guns here, too, and they don't have any liability to see if they should?
That's part of it. I mean, here in Colorado, you don't even have to register a gun. So if I had one, I could just give it to you or sell it to you or give it to you.
And nobody has to know?
No one has to know.
That's weird.
Yeah,
okay.
We don't have registration here in Colorado.
Okay.
And that just, that's one of the few things that, it's a conglomerate of all these different, and it's really complicated too. Here in the United States, we live in a big country, right? And we have all sorts of different states, and we have the red ones and the blue ones, and everyone has their different opinions and lives their different lives in these different areas.
Well, okay, I'm gonna pause right there. So
hey, go ahead.
Even in Colorado, here's this concept I was talking about with a friend. A lot of people call Colorado Springs the red bleeding heart of Colorado.
Yeah.
And because on average for a while now, like, the citizens of Colorado Springs vote against the rest of Colorado.
Really?
And the biggest reason that Colorado gets labeled as a blue state is because Denver has a much larger population.
Yeah.
And most of the people live in Denver, and Denver is a very liberal area. But if you look at the politics vote by vote, that's a big reason why Colorado Springs still doesn't have recreational marijuana. And I'm pretty sure we just voted against it again.
Yes, we did. It was some 20,000 votes or something. Or actually, it might have been like 30,000 votes, something like
so
that. It was ridiculous.
The rest of the state's been wrecked for fucking 2 decades.
And
we're still going against it.
And the really hypocritical thing, too, the irony of it, is we then voted yes for the taxes on said recreational pot that
yeah.
we don't have.
And they're trying to weasel in the regulation of the mushrooms, too. But
yeah, thankfully that did pass.
Yeah, yeah. It's good, but they're going to get money out of it, and that's a big motivating.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But, all right, so...
Oh, but yeah, just with the, with the gun laws and stuff, like I was saying too, depending on who you ask, because I can have my side and everyone has their own side, but then...
What's making people flinch? Is it simply just their control being taken away? Is it because they have this freedom to be able to willingly give it and take it, and because... Just the idea of having less control, is that the flinch material? Is that why people are going against it?
I think it's a really interesting way to look at it, because then, to look at both sides of it and say, yeah, with guns, a lot of people will say, there's the come and take it thing, and, a lot of people are concerned about, getting their AR-15s or whatever taken away. But then you go over to, that's the right of it, the Republican side of it mainly. But then you go over to the left and you look at this last year and Roe versus Wade being overturned with, the right for abortion. And that actually brought so many people, so many young people specifically, to vote. And you could say the same thing, whereas they were... people are scared, especially women, and
yeah.
me being a guy, scared for those women.
It was big. I remember
yeah.
that. I remember, yeah.
And, losing their control over that, and that's because that's a right they've enjoyed for the past 50 years now. And in the same way, you could say that we've enjoyed the right to guns since 1776, I guess, right? So,
And it's this idea that, Another argument I've heard about it, just to play devil's advocate, is if you have an invading force, or even if your invading force is the government.
Sure.
If it ever comes down to it, the only way is to make, like, local militia, which would be, you know, like, people gathering together to fight against said government or invading force,
mm-hmm.
would be to have a well-armed militia, which is what fueled the revolution and all that.
Right.
It's how we could fight against Imperial England, even though it was a global powerhouse that could, like, basically owned a quarter of the world at that point.
No, and yeah, there's something definitely to be said about that, for sure. You know, you look at what's happening in Ukraine right now, and, you know, you can wonder where they would be without all the weapons that they now have, you know, and they're doing a wonderful job defending their own country. And, you know, I guess the big thing I see with the gun debate is that a lot of times people can use that argument, but then even if in some way, you know, they're saying that to someone and that argument gets I can't think of it off the top of my head, but there's different ways to debate where you can, you know, dismantle these types of arguments. They then jump around to a lot of different things, and it kind of seems a lot of the time that they try to use different debates in a or different narratives to fit what they already believe to be right, instead of looking at evidence and then finding the objective point from said evidence.
Well,
you know,
I personally would say that it's not black and white.
Oh yeah,
it's
not, definitely isn't.
No situation is ever black and white. And I think that there is probably a possibility to have people having their freedoms, but also having it be safe, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And having some form of regulation, like New Zealand, or some sort of educational way to have people habituated maybe from childhood to know how and what a gun is used for.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't personally own weapons, but I've taught my son how to be very safe with a stove because it has the potential to harm somebody.
Right.
You know, like, maybe there needs to be a thick culture about how not to hurt people with weapons instead of a thick culture about freedom of having them.
Well, yeah. And yeah, that's probably part of it too. Yeah, right. Or, I'm sorry, I interrupt you, guys.
No, you go.
Just the, you know, the violence aspect of, you know, we're very weird as Americans about things like sex, you know, in movies, for example.
Yeah, but you
when
have
it comes
PG-13. That's
you know.
Nine heads off.
But, I mean, the point being, though, is then violence, though, you can look at a sex scene and, you know, we're still uneasy about a
yeah.
sex scene. We can't watch a sex scene with our parents, for example. But you see, you know, Jason Statham or, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger go and, you know, kill 50 different people. You know, it's not the same thing. There's not as much of a stigma behind it. And, you know, that can have an effect, I feel like.
I agree. And, like, so. I've seen that within my own personal ecosystem. Like, because I've always still been nervous. Like, as a parent, I feel uncomfortable about my son seeing sexual content.
Yeah.
And it is weird that we can watch gratuitous violence and that, like, he can, like, that's the thing I'm most worried about. And I've often worried. Thought about that deeply,
yeah,
because that's a weird little mine inside my head, like, but that's part of this societalization. And like, I've seen it even with drug use, you know, because I think the stigma of drug use has gone up, and I've often been arguing that the stigma behind drug use is like, if anything, one of the major fuels for the attitude and the crises that we see with things like opiates and, you know, alcoholism in our country. You know, not to say that drug use isn't damaging and the toxic effects aren't there.
Right.
But I think that the stigma that we feel builds this shame and guilt circuit that makes people use more.
And perpetuates the issue.
Yes, yes, because we're so shameful of ourselves.
Yeah. You know, what you're speaking to, also, I've watched this thing on, I watched this kind of documentary type deal about this guy. Have you ever heard of Dr. Bruce Alexander? He was the creator of something called Rat Park.
I don't think so, but you can describe.
So you'll love this. This is really interesting. It basically, when we were testing cocaine, you know, morphine, all those different things. We were doing them on rats, right? Now, when we were doing that and doing those tests, a lot of these tests were coming out and all the rats were just eating it up, you know, really like a lot. And so this guy, Dr. Bruce Alexander, he ended up going back and saying, well, hold on, that's not right. There is something that we didn't, there's a variable we did not control for, and that's the fact that, I mean, what do rats do regularly? And then we took them out of that environment and put them in this other environment. You know, look at it from a human standpoint, right? We just, yeah, if we're being put in a box that's just barely five times the size of our body,
and it's depressing,
and the only little thing, you know, is just a water feeder with a little button or whatever, and that's what, you know, that leads to the drugs that makes us happy or whatever. What do you think the rats are going to do?
But it's a metaphor for society.
But, yeah, and so it what he basically did, right, is he wanted to do the experiments again. Basically, he got a whole bunch of rats, got them addicted to morphine, and he might have done it with cocaine, too. And basically, he built this whole, after they were well and addicted to these drugs and dependent on them physically, he built what he refers to as Rat Park. Now, he put, you know, little hamster wheels and different, and there's wood chips in there, and, you know, it was big and spacious, and, you know, there was food, and, you know, it was happy, and there were tons of rats in there, other rats, you know, so the rats can hang out and, you know, form relationships and whatnot. And so he got these addicted rats and put, or dependent rats, and put them in Rat Park.
In a happier, better environment.
A happier environment. And after it was some 2 or 3 weeks, just slowly, they all stopped using. And it's stunning to, like, think about the concept. They all stopped using for some, it wasn't immediate. You know, they were still going because he put a regular water thing, but then he also put the drugs back in there. So they still could use it if they wanted to. And even though at the beginning, sure, some of them were still using it at the start, they slowly either weaned themselves off or just stopped using altogether and stopped focusing on it. Before he knew it, all the rats weren't even using the drugs whatsoever. And so they just were living their happy rat lives. And so there's something to be said about, yeah, our environments and just the stigmas behind drug use, and
I think
looking at
it,
so
much worse,
as a societal problem as compared to a personal thing, you know?
Yeah, like, I would say we have a relationship with these chemicals.
Mm.
And just like we can get into a relationship with a bad person, and some people are more toxic, you know? There's a spectrum of bad that you can be in. Like, you can be in a relationship where somebody's, like, literally beating you, you know? Like, or you can be in a relationship where, like there's a spectrum of badness, you know? Like, and so I'd say things like alcohol and, you know, morphines and opiates and cocaine and, like, but the human body can handle caffeine for a bit longer than crystal meth, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but it's a range in the relationship to these things, you know? And I would even say that some people somehow have incredibly functional relationship with these things sometimes.
Yeah.
You know? I don't.
Yeah, definitely not me, yeah.
I don't have the willpower, but, you know, minus the stigma and add in the historical context of the attitude towards it, you know, like back in the 1800s when, you know, you had the Shakespeares and all the big writers of Victorian England, the stigma around drug use was non-existent, you know.
Was it?
There was no puritanical efforts. You know, there was, like, dozens of opium pipes found in Shakespeare's yard. He was an open user of cocaine and various opiates, probably morphine, too.
Cough syrup was just, like, it had heroin in it.
Everything was freely available, and there wasn't, well, admittedly, it probably wasn't the best environment because of the ignorance around the damage that came from some of these things.
Right.
But
Back when tobacco was good for you, right?
No. Well, I think people have always known smoking is not good, because you can read anti-smoking ads in China going back to 500 BC.
No way.
Yeah.
I've never heard that. That's crazy.
Yeah. There's always been campaigns going against nicotine. It's just remarkably available and easy to get into people's hands.
Yeah.
That's something about the fidget. But this idea of addiction wasn't whole stream, you know, and I'm yet again I can't go back and see what it looked like, but I'm curious to see the differences in how people responded to their addictions,
right,
or their relationships with these things in a different, very different social environment where you could easily do it. You know, some cultures throughout society, the only type of like water that was clean was, you know, alcoholic beverages like beer. You know, so for a lot of mainstream societies in like barbarian England, they're always drunk.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But I wonder, but I'm sure there's no stigma around it. You know, like, I'm just curious, you know?
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. Definitely. Yeah.
But Rat Park is really fucking cool too.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And in my own experience with things like alcohol, I drank for a long time, for like years I drank my life away.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine ever doing that again. And it's because my relationship with that idea of being is just, it's so dramatically different now.
Yeah.
You know, I can't watch TV, like, and every once in a while I still drink, like a little bit just to remember, you know, like it's almost as like, as a temperance thing to remind myself. And every once in a while, I have, like, a tickle, you know, and I probably drink, like, once every 2 or 3 months, you know, and I drink every day for years. And the one thing I always realize is I can't watch TV, like, I can't remember anything I watched if I watch TV on it. And I'm not a big TV watcher, but I can't read when I'm drunk, you know? And, like, I'm a prolific, I mean, that's not the right word, I read a lot, and I'm perpetually stoned. You know, like, and that has no hindrance in my ability to read all of my studies, and a little bit of alcohol, and all of a sudden I'm so uninspired I can't read anything, I can't drink anything, I can't remember anything, you know, like, so there's this natural pull away from it where I have no inclination to want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And on paper I know I was an alcoholic, you know, and I'm worried about telling people that they're permanently broken from these things, you know, like, just like we can get over a bad relationship with a person, we can learn how to not be with a person like that ever again, and that part of that might be never seeing them again too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like a lot of your decisions as we've talked about.
Yeah.
And your sobriety.
Yeah.
But like the guilt that follows it though.
Mm-hmm.
That shit, that's part of that fear, I think, you know.
Yeah.
When it comes to that.
Yeah, with my ex, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, not at all. You haven't cut me off once.
No.
Okay.
With my ex, I've seen her a couple times over at the, you know, I think I told you I take methadone, and so
you did not at all.
I didn't?
No.
Yeah, I'm on.
How has that been? What's your opinion of this?
I think it's a lifesaver for people who need it. If I think it should be used as a last resort.
And
though.
You followed the protocol very closely, I assume, right?
Not for the first year, but, you know, and that actually gave me some really bad setbacks. Made me had to go up to a higher dose because
yeah.
I was still using.
My mother was
there.
Like at 150, and it took her like a while to
yeah.
wean herself off.
Yeah, I got up to, for a long time I was at 80 milligrams. That was my sweet spot, but I ended up, I'd go through these cycles of using for like 4 or 5 days a week or something.
And you wouldn't take your meds? Would you avoid the clinics at those times? Because you can't mix it very well, can you?
I would still do it, but then I was more prone to, you know, because they close at like 12 p.m. And so a lot of times I'd be sleeping during the early hours of the day to where I'd miss it, and I'd be like, oh, okay, well, I just gotta, you know, I gotta supplement more with actual drugs though. And one thing is, it really messes with your tolerance too, to where I know you're saying like maybe you can't mix them together. You can, but the thing is,
I've heard part of the
you won't get high anymore from using like drugs if you're on the methadone.
You ever heard of kratom?
Yeah, and I've thought about it. So I haven't gone as far to buy any.
One of my favorite things about kratom is, have you ever heard of Anabuse? Sorry, just to dig down this rabbit hole a little bit further. And I cut you off. I apologize.
No, you're good.
I'm sure we'll get back on it.
What was Anabuse?
You ever heard of Anabuse?
Huh.
So Anabuse is a medication you get prescribed if you've been drunk driving too many times and you've been deemed dangerous.
Oh, and so it prevents you from drinking?
It gets rid of the protein in your stomach that can dissolve and absorb alcohol. So if you don't have that protein, alcohol hits your nervous system as a pure poison. And it makes you so sensitive that, like, a couple sips of a beer could make you feel very ill. Like,
and so it makes you sick, huh?
Well, because you can't process it anymore.
Right.
And alcohol is a poison.
Sure, yeah.
And the only reason we can do it is because we have a magical stomach that does some stuff to it.
With the liver, right?
No, well, it's probably more in the intestines, in the part, I don't know. Anyways, Anabuse, as a key, though, makes it so you cannot drink. Like, when it's in your bloodstream, you drink it and you get very sick. So, kratom, I found, is like Anabuse for opiates.
Really?
Kratom is an opioid. So it's the mu opiate receptor, which is what morphinergic drugs hit. Mu stands for morphine. But it also hits the kappa opiate receptor, which is a completely separate receptor. And it has a litany of other chemicals like in it that also affect a whole bunch of other different lines. So whereas classical opiates have one thing that they're hammering on, kratom is an opioid because it has a very varied effect. And it's not completely effective on the mu opiate receptor. Whereas drugs like heroin and morphine are complete agonists of the mu opiate receptor, kratom is what's called a partial agonist.
Kind of like Suboxone.
Yeah, whereas marijuana is a partial agonist of the THC receptor, the endocannabinoid receptors, but a full agonist, like the stuff that was in spice, was giving people heart attacks.
Really? So lethal. Spice was a full I never knew that.
Some of those, there was a lot of other research chemicals that were endocannabinoid agonists, and a lot of those chemicals were just very, very good at what they were doing, and that was literally killing people.
And giving them seizures and ruining their stomach lining, all sorts of crap.
So there's a huge difference between kratom and opiates, is what I'm trying to argue here.
Interesting.
And from personal experience, like, I had surgery a couple years back, and I'm bad with opiates, so they gave me a script of Vicodin. It was supposed to last me 2 weeks, and I ate it in like 2 days.
Oh, jeez.
And on the last end of the second day, I was to the point where, like, I was only catching a good buzz off the pill for, like, maybe an hour and a half, you know, before I wanted another one. And that was where I was at when I ate the last one. And so, like, 2 hours later, I was like, oh, fuck, I'll just eat some red kratom. Because red is more sedating stuff. And I ate, like, my standard dose, 2 grams, and I got so sick. Like, sick as a dog.
Jeez.
Like, and I've read other, like, other subjective personal reports of other people getting sick when trying to mix opiates with their kratom.
Interesting.
So, like, as an opiate addict, and as a kratom addict now, because I've been eating it for, like almost 10 years. I ate some kratom right before I got here. but I've found that it's kind of cool because I have to take a lot of time before I go get something if I'm going to go make a bad decision.
Yeah.
And I found that most bad decisions happen very quickly.
Yeah.
And so if I have to sit for 12 hours and think about it, usually I change my mind.
You know the crazy thing? When I used to be on Suboxone, I would plan for my using where what you're talking about actually didn't work on me. I don't know if it would now. I think it probably would now because in what I know with cravings, actually, most cravings last an average of like 7 minutes, right?
Really?
Yeah, the really hard cravings.
The intense part of it.
Yeah.
And there can be waves of that, I'm sure. It could be like a staccato rhythm.
Yeah.
7 minutes.
Yeah,
7 minutes,
definitely.
7 minutes. 7 minutes.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. No, it didn't come back, right? But yeah, and I would actually, so I'd be on like a milligram. I'd have these 8 milligram strips of Suboxone, and I'd be on like a milligram or 2 milligrams or whatever. And so I'd take a milligram in the morning, milligram at night. And so if I decided I wanted to use throughout the day or whatever, I would say, ooh, I want to go get high. I'm going to go get high tomorrow or whatever, because with Suboxone, it has the naloxone, or like the pill form of what's Narcan, basically, to stop the opiates from acting on the receptors. And so I just wouldn't take my night dose, wouldn't take my morning dose, and by then I'd be kind of sick. But then I would go and get some drugs and, you know, get some black and go and use. And then maybe I wouldn't be getting fully high, but then I would, you know, use enough to like go to sleep that night, and by that next day I would be able to get high. And then I'd use for a couple days, and I don't know how I used to do this in function.
So imagine
then
getting
get
sick
back
as
off.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Imagine getting violently ill, like puking.
It makes me wonder too, like, so being on methadone,
like,
right?
Like
if I could use it to get off of methadone, but then it would it just get me sick because methadone is a long-acting opiate?
I don't think they would mix well.
Yeah.
But if you ever wanted to transition onto something different, if you were considering going through that process once you were in a cleaner space,
mm-hmm.
I highly advocate, as a fellow opiate addict, I think kratom could save lives.
Definitely.
Mitragine, which is the active compound in kratom, they've given live test rats their body weight, basically, like an incredibly high LG50 of mitragine. And you'll see some of the rats get very sick.
And that's a chemical in kratom?
Mitragine, yeah.
Okay.
And there's also hydroxymitragine, there's like citrophylline, there's like a list of 26 of them.
Uh-huh.
It's just like cannabis, like, you know how there's a lot of different
cannabinoids.
So there's a lot of different strains of kratom too, because the different ratios of those compounds lead to dramatically different subjective effects.
Huh.
So certain leaves have very different effects. Like white kratom is a different species than red kratom, and white kratom is very stimulating. Like, one of the biggest reasons I like kratom is that it's called a very stimulating opiate, but it's not like a stimulant. Like, I would prefer the word motivating.
It just doesn't landlock you.
It gives you the give a shits.
Couch potato.
It gives you the give a shits. It makes you very, very involved in what you're doing.
Interesting.
You know, like, it's not something you take to go get sedated. Even the red stuff is remarkably comfy, which red is more sedating. Like, but it's not, like, I've never nodded on kratom.
Interesting.
Ever.
Okay.
And no matter what dosage. You get to a point where you eat a little bit and you'll get sick. Like, but it won't kill you. You know, you can get very, very sick on kratom. And I've been some of the worst, like, vertigos of my life.
Oh, wow.
But it tells you when you're not supposed to eat anymore, so it's very hard to abuse it or to chase it like another substance.
Huh.
Like, it's like training wheels for opiate addicts, is what I think of
it. That's a funny way to put it.
Like, yeah, but what was I thinking? It's a very interesting plant. I've been eating it for a very long time.
Yeah.
I think it could save lives. Oh, the last little bit I wanted to tell you. Ha, there it is. So, opiates kill people by depressing the respiratory system,
mm-hmm.
because
they're
complete mu opiate agonists. Once the nervous system gets to a point of depression, you can no longer get oxygen into your blood. So most people who are ODing on heroin turn blue because they're asphyxiating from inside. They're no longer able to breathe for their brain, and that's how somebody dies. Where you shoot them with adrenaline, you hope that their nervous system gets enough juice to start breathing for you again. And if they get a couple breaths, just like after you drown, you come back, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so kratom, for some reason, mitragine completely avoids or ignores the respiratory system.
Huh.
Which is one of the reasons why I think that scientists think it's non-lethal. Like, because it has one of the lowest LD50s of any substance, just like cannabis, you know, or even psilocybin. You can eat a lot of mushrooms and get very sick.
Right.
It's very hard. It's very hard to kill yourself on psilocybin.
What's LD50? What's that mean?
It's like a lethal dose 50. It's a rudimentary thing that they use. Like, they usually use rabbits or rats, and it's like a body weight thing, like milligrams.
Oh, okay. It's a way to differentiate,
like cocaine. Cocaine's
bad and
incredibly
and
lethal.
Right.
Like, you, like, some people, if they don't have the wherewithal, they can kill themselves with less than a gram. Like some, like it's incredibly lethal. Like liquid pure cocaine can kill people like that.
Jeez.
Yeah, like, but cannabis, people, like, I think they say, like, smoking it, like, at the rate you can smoke it, it's like your body weight, which is, it's impossible to smoke.
Right, yeah. Like, yeah, smoke your body weight's worth of THC or whatever.
Yeah, which you can get damn close with edibles, but even then, that'd be, like, ridiculous fucking edible, like.
That's funny.
All right, so you're talking about Suboxone and methadone again, and I'm still curious.
Do you
think it's been a benefit, like...
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, it has. Definitely. You know, I think something had to give in 2018. I couldn't even tell you how long exactly, but every 2 months average, I went to jail just on different possession charges, you know, just nodding out in my car. It was getting bad. I was very unfunctional. I was at a very unfunctional point, you know, in my addiction. I think a lot of people end up getting to after a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. And so something had to give, and I got out for the fifth time the end of 2018. I got now, and so I finally made the jump to go and get on methadone, because it had to stop. You know, for me, it wasn't even stopping using.
Did you heroin. Not, you didn't feel that you had the control to get out of it without this assistance, which is not a bad thing to have to admit.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of times where we need help.
Right, exactly. And so I, you know, if I could go back and tell I always ask myself this, you know, and I tell people this, if I could go back to, you know, that me and smack me and say, you know, you really need to get a hold of yourself to the point of, you know, finding another route, because this is going to be very hard to get off of when you are on it. You know, it's, you're going to be in it for the long haul, and I'm still going through it. But, you know, but again, you know, you can't, hindsight's always 20/20, but you can't ever see what's going to happen in the future 100% for sure.
And that thing,
you know,
the best way to explain it to somebody who's never used an opiate is it's the feeling of incredible hunger when you haven't had anything to eat for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the drive that you have towards getting food when you're very hungry.
Yeah.
And your brain gets foggy and you can't think straight because you desire so badly for that food item. That's the exact same feeling that opiates piggyback on.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same feeling they have to get them to get back to you. You know, like, I always call it the hag, you know, like some like creepy old witch.
Yeah.
You know, like, but...
You know, in a weird way, methadone kind of takes that,
that away. System.
Yeah, because it's...
It doesn't feel as good, or what?
I think just because you're out of the fight or flight kind of like withdrawal mode, your brain just going haywire and like
needing.
Because
you don't feel sick.
Yeah, because you don't feel sick. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it is, you know, for me personally, it has a numbing effect to where it's not something you notice though until it's gone, right? So then if you miss a dose or something, you know, and that's something going, because I'm going down on my dose actually currently too, to where. You know, you feel that a lot more, and you notice it's like, wow, I can actually feel feelings again. You know, I'm trying to work on coping with that just as a general concept, just life in general, you know, coping with feeling feelings again, because that numbness isn't there and I'm having to learn, relearn things.
Whereas
so.
They feel pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, they can, and I do like it, but at the same time, it could be
it
really
is a,
hard.
It is a roller coaster.
Yeah.
You know, life.
That's a good way to put it.
And this being, you know, like, I definitely don't have my shit together by a long run, you know? Like, I deal with mental qualms, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of take... I don't want to say the Buddhist view on it, like, because I think there's a lot of different schools of thought that grow into it, this sort of ideology, but I see my myself as being separate from the baggage that I'm carrying. Like, another metaphor would be is, like, I see my personality as
a weird way to put it, seeing yourself as separate from the baggage.
I see my personality as the exact same separation as, like, me having to wear clothing. You know? Like, the opinions and the desires and the wants that I have are completely spontaneous because of life itself. And a lot of things are just purely accidental and chaotic. And a lot of negative things that happen are just purely chaos.
Yeah. You know,
not some people will hurt other people, and that's not direct chaos. But a lot of the shit that happens is just, and a lot of things that are difficult and stressful are just purely happenstance.
Well, it's like they say in, like, physics, right? You know, if you have a certain amount of atoms, like atoms, you know, and you put a apple in a box, right, and you seal that box, and you let it deteriorate over time, eventually it's going to evaporate, and it's going to turn to dust. And there's this theory that in, like, physics, where it will eventually, at some point, if you just infinitely over time just leave it there, not only form into this, form into that, form into any number of things, but then even at some point form back into
a
perfect
apple. Like, there's chance even after a million years.
After, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's such a crazy thing. Yeah, so I'm definitely a believer in the fact that, yeah, there's a lot of chaos, you know, within the world, so.
But we have chaos within ourselves, too, you know? And in the same way that I think that our body is impacted by external stimuli, I think there's this range of motions that we have within ourselves, within our emotional waters, that contain fear and intense joy and pleasure and contentment. You know, like, there's all these drops of weather that we have inside as well that are internal stimuli, you know. But just like the external affects how I perceive things, I think there's stuff percepting or affecting my perceiver from the inside as well. Because at least I try to be very open-minded when these things come, if that makes any sense. Like, at all.
Yeah, like, no, I think I'm following, yeah.
I know it's a little hoodoo.
It's a little hoodoo. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's something I'm kind of grappling with, too. Just, you know, I really felt in control of my, I just, in general, my body, my emotions, so much to, like, a cynical point, I guess.
During what?
Just in general, just day-to-day, you know, just throughout my life. But then, you know, after the bad situation I had with, with LSD,
yeah.
I ended up, I don't feel in control. And I guess that subconsciously, it's a scary thing,
yeah.
too, you know. So after so many years of feeling
is
like
control necessary? Because I certainly don't feel in control of anything at all, like, either.
You know, logically, no, right? Like, I think about it in my head, and I'm like, there's so many things in my life I can't control.
What can you actually physically control? Like,
I guess, like, emotions is one thing. But
can anybody actually control their emotions? Because I've rarely seen somebody who's completely in control of their emotions.
I used to have a pretty good grip, though. I wouldn't say I was in complete control, but I had a pretty good grip. Whereas I don't
now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that also infers that there could be another tide where you might have a grip again. You know? Like, I don't think that there's at least concrete evidence to assume that you're never going to have a grip again on it. You know? But these emotions that we have, I think, come down the stream of happenings, of happenstances, you know, just like the bullshit outside as well, you know. And, like, a lot of it is great, you know, but there's a lot of stuff that can be detrimental. What I do think we do have a modicum of control over, to an extent, is reactions to emotions.
Yeah.
You know, like, when the emotions do come, I think with especially practice, we can learn how to wrestle with them better. But I still don't know how to wrestle my emotions down most of the time. You know, I still have a lot of aggressive outbursts that I'm not fond of, you know, with people that I shouldn't be doing it with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that never helps my circumstances. And I'm very aware of my torments, my tempers, you know, my little tornadoes that are like always whirling around, you know. But like the analogy of the child and the family, if we put that thing and lock it up, like if somebody were to lock you up in a room, you'd want out, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, definitely.
Like, so being stuck with these emotions, just like we're stuck with this life, like, I think the best part is not to exactly try to control them, but learn where we're at when we're there, you know? Like, you can't judge yourself for how you used to be able to react to these things.
Yeah.
Nobody can. And look around and you'll see a lot of other people dealing with their own shit too.
Right.
Like, that makes me feel better sometimes. Not in a cynical way.
Right.
I do it very compassionately. I
right.
have a lot of compassion.
In an empathetic way. Right? Yeah. Being able to relate, you know. Yeah, no, I definitely feel that. I'm a very empathetic person myself. Empathetic to a fault in anything. So, you know, that's where, you know, I guess it makes me wonder. That's the $1 million question, right? What is the answer to, like, you know, when you're talking about, you know, locking an emotion up in a room, what is exactly that emotion that I got locked up inside of
mm-hmm.
me, you know?
You gotta figure that out.
Yeah.
You think it's possible you could ask, and like maybe not to like directly be schizophrenic, but maybe just investigate, you know, like from a compassionate way.
Yeah.
Like in a soft way, of course. Like, not to get too hoodoo.
I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe I should try and meditate or something to...
Have you ever meditated?
Lightly, a couple of times, but no, I'm not a pro at it by any means.
Yeah.
So, but I'm aware of the concepts. But,
it's a murky term. And, like, I found myself not meditating for a while. And I used to be really good at it, I thought. You know, it was just weird. And, like, I felt kind of bad about it. And I carried some guilt and shame over my inability to do it recently. But I used to be able to sit in meditation for 2.5 hours straight.
Really?
And I was just so comfortable with silence and with my quietude and able to sit inside myself and craft that space. But...
See, that's not something I'm comfortable with.
There's a lot of schools of thought that argue over its necessity, too. You know, like, a lot of people would say quietude may be good. And I would argue an essence of quietude might be helpful for you if you could learn how to craft a space of calm. Because
uh-huh.
when we're feeling up and very afraid and in that state of anxiety, that's exactly what we need to know how to do, is able to sedate ourselves.
Right.
You know, and one thing I do know that I've learned from my old quietude, you know, because I can barely sit down for 5 minutes nowadays. You know, like I think the longest meditation I've had in months is probably 10 minutes.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, and I literally just feel compelled to get up. And it's because that's where I have to be right now, is I have things to work on and things to do. But there's a way to meditate mindfully in activity, too, just by really watching what's going on, you know? Like, and...
Mindfulness, right?
Observingness.
Yeah.
Like... when we're counting the seconds while we're stretching and we're counting to 30, all of our observationism is completely absorbed in the counting, not the stretching. One of my favorite book authors, and one of the quotes I always like to push out, is this dude named Alan Watts. And he said, whilst you're watching the waves hit the floor, or hit the shore, sorry, you can't think about the waves hitting the shore while watching them. Because if you're thinking about it, you're not actually watching it anymore. There's a state of awe that comes when we're watching something, you know? Like, I get it all the time here because we have beautiful mountains. And sometimes when I'm driving to work and you see the sunrise at the mountains, you know, there's always sometimes these little spaces and moments where you're not even thinking about anything, but just that really beautiful spot. Like, I've seen it in the clouds, too. Like,
so crazy how these simplest things can be so profound, you know?
It's... That's what I spend most of my time looking into.
Yeah.
Like,
I've had a lot of that lately, too, where it's like, I feel like I go through a lot of, like, cliches of just, you know, learning things that everyone else has known for a long time, but I'm just, like, figuring out now, you know, where things seem profound to me, but then they're, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example, too, where, I mean, just kind of like what you're saying with the Alan Watts quote, you know. Just,
have you ever heard of him?
Yeah, yeah.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, and so just the, you know, watching the waves and, you know, not thinking about watching them, because then you're not really even watching them if you're thinking about watching them, because you're distracting yourself, I guess.
With the thinking.
Yeah, with thinking, yeah. And so, yeah, it's just such a profound thing, you know. I don't know, it's really cool. I like that quote, though. That's cool. That's
you should listen to that more. There's a lot of his stuff on YouTube. He has, like, probably 100, like, at least 100 hours of his speeches that you can listen to for free.
Really?
Huh. He was a big talker, and he gave lectures all the time. He also wrote books, but he was not as good of an author as he is a speaker. And I feel that for a lot of people, it's a lot easier to listen to somebody. Like, you can listen to people while you're working.
Yeah.
If you're driving, you can't read a book while you're driving. Like, I like books the most, but
I want to read more, you know. But,
so back to profundity, which I thought that was funny. So they went to an Eskimo. I'm pretty sure this is something that Alan Watts told too. It's probably what's in my head. But a scientist goes to an Eskimo. And when they got there, the Eskimo was telling, like, profound knowledge and, like, writing down, like, he was, like, a wisdom guy. Like, he was, like, a shaman of the tribe. And they were asking him questions about life and stuff. And a lot of the things this dude was saying was, like, you know, stay in the moment. You know, like all these things about, like... And the most profound things are the most vague things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's why wisdom texts, like the Tao and, like... the words of Buddha and, like, some of the words of Jesus, for instance, you know, just to pull out some of these direct words that speakers and leaders said, you know, and I think all these people are human. Like, but what's buried in all these vague things that you have deciphered up through history, you know, and then come out, like, all these cliches,
mm-hmm.
The reason they're so profound is because they're common and vague. You know, one of the things that they say about Taoism and the Tao Te Ching, which is one of my favorite schools of thought, is that wisdom is flavorless. You know, like, a good friend is flavorless like water, whereas a bad friend and a bad habit, you know, tastes sweet like candy. You know, like, I don't know if I'm saying that right. I'm rather stoned too. But, like, that's what you find, those profound things is buried in those, and that's what I've gone towards, like, old primary texts. You know, I've spent a lot of time with religious texts because they're old, and because I had a reactionary clinching to religion, because I spent so much time thinking I was atheist and being countercultural, so I spent a lot of time arguing against religion and fighting it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think a lot of people have a bad upbringing with religion. You know, I'm like,
I
grew up in Christianity, so I had this bad taste organization in my mouth.
Yep, same here.
So when I first started down my rabbit hole of looking for something, I just called it seeking, you know, like, I started with religious texts because it was such a hard one to approach.
Really?
Know?
Okay.
And I thought, this is going to be the hardest one for me to get anything out of. And yet again, I was shocked. You know, but I also read from Western philosophy. I read from Plato, Aristotle, you know, Socrates, you know, like, all the Greeks. You know, I've spent a lot of time with people like Nietzsche. And I've spent a lot of time with Eastern philosophy, too, you know, because a lot of these Eastern philosophies, like Buddhism, you know, like classical Buddhism, like the real basics of Buddhism, like Zen and some old Mahayanic practices that go back to Siddhartha. You know, these sort of things don't have gods, you know? Like, to become Buddha, you know, the aspect of finding enlightenment is to become Buddha.
Hmm.
You know, because once we're enlightened, we're awakened to the fact that there's no duality anymore. You know, there's no subject and object. The Buddha is everything. It's like it's the aspect of becoming, you know, if all of reality on this whole universe was like one organism, you know, and we're just like these little parcels of cellular pieces of that organism, you know, but that could be even bigger than that, you know, like some like there's like stupid analogies that they say, like in these like old books, like try to describe that immensity, you know, like, so there is no God once subject and object disappear. Like, that's the big thing I've always had a conflict with Christianity, is because you always have God, and we're the guilty, shameful humans who sinned. There's always a subject and an object.
You know? Oh, that's what you mean by subject and object. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, like, the aspect of Buddhahood is anti-duality.
Right.
So imagine that wall being gone. You know, that would be becoming the environment.
Yeah, I can get behind that.
Is one way that I thought about it. So, like, there's a lot of very interesting Eastern philosophies that I've looked into. Like, a lot of this shit's free. Like, you can find a lot of these books for free because they're so old.
Huh. Outside of copyright, right?
You can just look them up on Google.
Yeah. No, I always thought, too, like, if I... you know, my Grammy, she tells me, it's like, you need to read the Bible more. It's like,
that's
I've never actually read the Bible and fully, you know, I've read bits and pieces of it, but...
So you want an interesting one? I haven't read the Bible, but I've read the Torah. So the Torah is the first five books. It's the Pentateuch.
Right, it's like the Old Testament.
Genesis.
The Bible's the New Testament.
Yeah. So when I was reading through the Torah, lo and behold... In the first three books, there's absolutely no mention of hell. In old archaic Judaism, there was only El Sheol, so there was no heaven and hell. So everyone who died went to El Sheol.
Am I saying like a purgatory, or...?
It was just the afterlife.
Just the afterlife, okay.
Yeah, and I always found that highly compelling. Huh. So this signification of duality between heaven and hell came with an older books and older monasticisms after the classical Judaism. But Judaism comes from a lot of very intense paganism. Like when ancient Israelites were putting down those books, you know, like there was other people in the same region of Sumeria that were throwing people in gigantic iron bowls that were on fire. Like it was called Baal. And Baal was even mentioned in the Old Testament. They talk about the worshippers of Baal and the Israelites go and kill them, like in war. But like, very fascinating book. Like, it's worth the investigation if you ever find yourself curious into any direction. Like, I've even read a lot of science stuff too. Like,
yeah,
there's a lot of scientific stuff that's very interesting.
Okay. I was gonna say too that I always thought it's like, you know, if I were to read the Bible or if I were to read religious texts, if anything, I'd want to read, you know, I'd want to read all of them, right? I'd want to get different perspectives, just like you're saying, you know, mm-hmm. I'd want to read like the Quran, the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, and the you know, not only the Bible, but then the other ones too, and yeah, maybe into Buddhism and stuff too. I always thought that'd be interesting. So, just like you're saying, you pretty much said it yourself already. But you know, part of my issue with sitting, you know, just with myself, with my own thoughts, I feel like I'm a phone addict now. You know, have you heard about this concept?
Well, you type magnificently. Like, some people aren't wordy enough. Like,
yeah.
You've always typed me massive books in our conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is it's pretty cool. Like,
you do, honestly. Yeah. Well, you're in the minority.
It's hard to get people to have a conversation nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, about a lot of things. A lot of conversations are too simple. You know?
Right.
So, like, I think that's a good thing, to have that depth to your personality.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Like, but as far as technology goes and having the impulse... Like, I spend very little time on my phone. Like, not saying that there's a bad way of doing it. Like, because I used to spend a lot of time on social media. Like, and I think I did a good job when I was doing it. I just got tired. And
yeah.
So I stepped back out of it because selfishly I didn't want to be tired anymore. I wanted to spend my time doing other things. But I spent a lot of time on social media. Like, 2 years ago up until about a year ago. Like, here's an example. I joined 4 different flat earth groups and, like, literally devoted a healthy amount of attention to having a lot of conversations with flat earthers. And it was just part of my pet experiment of ideas because, yet again, I was looking for this ideology that I thought I'd have conflict with. And I found within flat earthology, people have an instinctual clinch to it. And the first thing that people say is blasphemous. There's no flat earthers. That's stupid. But there is real flat earthers out there. And so I wanted to go find these people and talk to them and figure out why they thought that from a healthy point of view. And I thought that that would be difficult for me. And so, like, I had, like hundreds of hours, you know, like, just spent online typing rapidly.
Yeah.
You know, back and forth to people. And I learned a lot. It was very tiring, you know. Like, as long as you feel like you're doing good work, though, like, here's my question. Do you spend more time consuming or creating?
Consuming, definitely. I actually have been... lately more so like posting on Instagram and stuff, but it's more for just like sentimental purposes because I have a lot of pictures on my phone and I want to try to lose them, so it's kind of like in a weird way Google Drive for me. I'm using Instagram as, but yeah, for the most part it's just Netflix and watching news on YouTube, so definitely consuming for sure. And you know, I feel like it's kind of replaced my drug addiction just with like phone addiction, and for some people it's really problematic, and I question sometimes if I'm one of those people now, you know.
My son.
Oh yeah.
This is his favorite thing. He'd do this till like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Well, have you tried creating, like using social media and or technology, like, or have you tried making things, like, period?
Just like in general, like I post my own pictures and
stuff. I've seen your opinion too. That's that counts.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, I do try to post different, I guess, yeah, just opinionated based stuff, but opinion based in evidence and reality, or at least I like to think of it that way.
Here's a challenge. You should spend like a week or two investigating deeply into a topic, because I've heard you do a lot of statistics and then present it. Like, you can either type it out or, like, do, like, a video. I don't know if you're willing to do that.
And what are you saying? So do what?
Present a topic.
Just
like,
present a topic.
Research something. Like, you were throwing a lot of statistics about gun stuff at me. I'm sure that you have a lot more patience with the internet than I do.
Yeah, I do.
Like, I don't know. Like, that's what I'm always trying to push people to do, is go make things. That's what saved my life.
Yeah.
This is my creations. This is one of them. I do a lot of art. I write. I make poetry. I've been writing poetry for several years, ever since I was a kid. Like, I found that when I started making things, and people respond well to you making things. This was something that I found, is that as a culture, as humans, we're pretty inclusive when it comes to supporting each other making things, for the vast majority. Like, with the way the technology is now, like, one of my pet theories is that, like, in 10 years, everybody's just going to be watching each other on YouTube. Like,
yeah.
We'll all just have videos of each other at home just doing really boring things, and people will just watch each other, you know, because of the availability of people being able to film each other, like with Twitch and gaming.
Yeah.
You know, like, that shit still blows my mind. I don't get it, but the kids love it. You know, watching other people watch movies, like that kind of idea.
Right.
Like, you know, like, but we love to watch other people do their thing. Like,
yeah.
And like, it feels good.
You know, and it's crazy too, because I don't subscribe to anything, but I do watch a lot of stuff. So like, a really good person is David Pakman.
Who's that?
So he refers to himself as a democratic socialist, I guess, or how do I put it? Well, he's like a progressive, right? That's how he identifies, though, with democratic socialism. So not socialism, but basically what they do over in like Nordic countries, right? So they have very good social safety nets, you know, things.
Well, black
like,
and white thinking is a big issue when we're even scared of the word socialism.
Yeah.
And you have to
yeah.
present it softly to me like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's
you know,
a good way. Yeah.
Like, no, I completely agree. There's going to be benefits. There's quite a few benefits in that system.
Yeah.
So this David Pakman guy, he does some sort of like...
He does just general,
like
you know, political... Yeah, journalism. He's a political pundit, I guess you could call him. But he uses statistics. He reports on empirical evidence and, you know, the facts. And he does a lot of dismantling of disinformation, too.
Fact checks.
So, yeah, fact checks, I guess you can call it. I don't know. I don't really like...
Could you see yourself being a David Pakman?
I think it'd be really cool. Yeah,
would you
that'd be
fine.
Cool.
Validated.
Maybe. I don't know. That's an interesting question. Maybe I would. You know, because I think I do want to work in some... You know, I'm a dog sitter now, and that's not going to last forever. You know, I've never been good about answering the question of, well, what do you think you're going to be able to... Or what do you see yourself doing in 5 years? Mm-hmm. But now I actually do have some aim, and I guess... whether that be entering into politics, whether that from getting landing a staffer job, you know, entering into state politics and potentially like a federal house seat or something, that'd be really cool, or doing something in media, but a good, you know, independent media, or yeah, even something myself potentially. You know, I don't know if I have the self-esteem to try and start that yet.
This is a pet project. This
yeah.
is my media project.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't make any money for this. You know, I rent a RSS feed for $25 every 6 months. And when I get, if I ever somehow got to a certain viewership amount, my RSS feed's rent would go up substantially. So within this media, the more people that listen to you, the more expensive it is to host it, you know. But good for me, it's pretty cheap still, and I have no interest in any monetary gain. One of my personal rules for me is that I have no interest of ever combining finances and my art. And like maybe someday it might happen by accident, but I'm not going to ever ask for it. Like if you've ever listened to podcasting in general, like one of the disgusting parts about it for me, even for my favorite shows, is every single show that's big has like at least like probably a tenth of its showtime devoted to either sponsorship
mm-hmm.
or asking for ad revenue or asking for donations. You know, like I've never done that once for the show, and I never plan to. You know, but there's a free part about having this technology, you know, through social media, through YouTube, through whatever, giving you platform
yeah
where for very little money you at least have a voice, you know, like anybody has a voice, you know, like right now, and that's kind of thrilling.
It is,
you
it
know
really is.
Like we're at a ability that we've never had before, like in our lives, like
yeah.
which is kind
of
cool.
That's a part of you know, I think the what you're talking about with certain things that have brought more violence in America towards the start of this, you know, more violence to America. I think that could be a part of it too with the media and just, yeah, there are a lot of things happening that we have never seen before. It's still relatively new over this past of less than 20 years.
Yeah.
Or just over 20 years, I guess you could call it. You know, because I mean, sure, the internet was around like during the 90s or whatever, but I mean, it wasn't really.
We
know,
grew up with
offices
it.
And whatnot.
We really grew up with it.
But
the
yeah.
internet is our generation because I remember its inception.
Yeah.
Like I remember being 3, and I remember when computers came indoors.
Oh yeah, and then
and
playing like the little space pinball game on the desktop, and yeah, Spider Solitaire and all
that. That is our generation.
Minesweeper.
Our lifespan is basically the internet. Like,
yeah.
And all of its grandiosity.
Yeah, and so we're finding out a lot of things. You know, that are happening with people like millennials and people like Gen Zers who are, you know, always on the internet and just these new generations and living with it and finding ways to cope with the bad parts of it and working out the kinks. And, yeah, there's a lot to do with it and a lot of things to figure out, I guess, still, you know, and so It's a really hard concept, though, to think about, right? Because, yeah, there's just so much we don't know. I don't know. I'm going in circles.
No, circles are the... Well, maybe a circle is just a spiral seen from above.
Yeah.
You still have ascension.
That's a good quote, yeah.
So, I think it starts internally first. I think we have a microcosm within our being. And I think, like, divinity and all of its hoodoo-ness is reflected inside. Like, when I speak with you and when I speak with anybody, like, I'm always very careful because I think the people are very special. And life is very special, you know? Like, even a tree is very special, you know? And, like, I think to deny consciousness to any sort of creature that has an existence is asinine and arrogant, you know? And, like, and that's why I like to use that word divine, in a way, you know, and I aspire towards a lot of these concepts from Eastern thought, you know, like, but when it comes to changing the world, I think what is inside is also equally reflected outside. And one of the biggest ways to influence people positively is to do it by being better, you know, and not like being better, like I'm better than you, man, but like living honestly, living compassionately. You know, living softly, living open to other people, you know, and that starts by being open ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, it has nothing to do with rationalizing about it or thinking about it. It's by being very sympathetic in every reaction and every interaction that we have in our life, you know?
I definitely agree, yeah.
And what I found is just being really good to a person, I bet you they're going to go be good to somebody else. And that might even go back 3-4 links away. Of other people that you have no idea exist.
I have a weird relationship with that, you know, because I like to think so, you know, I like to believe that, but then at the same time, I have a bad taste in my mouth from being around addicts, you know, because they can be very crappy.
Well, they're hungry.
Yeah.
They're so ravenous. They're so hungry and so thirsty.
Yeah.
Like,
so I
pity them badly, even the ones that have hurt me. You know, right. I pity them very badly. It's a very painful situation to be in. And the same goes for a lot of sober people out there that may be just incredibly bound up in their religions as well. Because I've also been hurt by a lot of very religious people in the same exact way. But they're so hungry and so thirsty for that kind of sentimentality as well, you know? Like,
sort of a gratification, I guess, whether it be... you know, companionship. A lot of people find that in church, just the camaraderie.
But I still pity them.
Yeah.
The same way I pity an addict, you know? Like, but individually, like, you can still be good to people, even if they've hurt you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, so, you can still have empathy, I guess. Yeah, that's how
you can
prefer.
You can be even good empathy, you can just be good to them.
Yeah.
You know, even to your worst enemy, you know, and hope that they might be good to somebody in their life, even if they're still your enemy.
It's kind of like with my dad, or like with, you know, there's this other guy, a dealer I used to have, Mike. This guy, I mean, he was the type of person who wanted what he wanted and wanted it 10 minutes ago, you know? And so he, you know, he was pretty self-centered, and but I still, we had a relationship, I loved him, you know, like, not like in that way, but, you know, I mean, like, we were always around each other, and, you know, I liked being around him and whatnot, even through all the dysfunctionality of it, but he, you know, and I'd always take him up to Cripple Creek, he liked to gamble, and so, and he, especially when he was trying to go up and gamble, he'd be extra, not in a good mood, and so just I used to tell people he used to be a very ornery dick. That's what I'd call it, but you know, I still love the guy, and as much as logically I could know that nothing, he would never really change, you know, I still in my heart, I guess, if that makes sense metaphorically, had to believe it was possible, just for my own logic of, like, you know, if it isn't possible, then what am I even doing still being around him and subjecting myself to his nonsense if you know, if it's not even possible for things to get better. So I guess I had to believe that, and it's my own kind of religion, you could say.
If somebody's getting hurt, I don't advise they continue being in contact with somebody who hurts them.
Yeah, well, and that's something I've recently learned, and, you know, like with my dad, too, you know, through a lot of my addiction. You know, I was starting to talk about it earlier, I think, where for 3 years now, it's, I've done my best to try and repair those relationships, but, and to an extent, I feel guilty, so I'm willing to deal with, you know, the different bad things that, like, my dad does or my sister does, and, you know, but I can't anymore. I just, it's gotten too much to the point where it's hurting me to where I can't let that guilt hold me back anymore.
And sometimes your absence is the best thing that you need to do.
Yeah.
And that can still be doing that person good as well.
Yeah.
In a way, you know.
I hope.
You hope. Like, and maybe in a stronger standpoint, you can go say your piece at some point.
Right.
When you're on a good footing, you know.
Well, and I've told them too. It's like, all I want from you is just to agree to go to therapy with me. That's it. You know, and he refuses to. I mean, he says he agrees, or he said he agreed once, but I mean, really, it was more of a, yeah, I'll go, now shut up type deal, you know, so, yeah, that's all I want from him personally, but, you know, it's not something he's ready to do. I find that a lot of the older generations tend to be, you know, I don't like the term set in your ways. I think that's a synonym for...
I would say, accurately, the older generation is materialistic, is based in a reductionist philosophy, where reductionism is this idea that you can explain things away.
Yeah.
Or you can reduce things into ideas of principle. In America, we're also bound up in this capitalistic ideal where people are self-sufficient, which I would also argue against. You know, financially, structurally, securely, nobody's self-sufficient.
Right.
You know, and only 1% of the population of our country makes more than $500,000.
Yep.
You know, like, in reality, a lot of people try really hard and they still can't make it. You know? Like, and that's part about that environment that we're in. Like trying to get out of that.
Yeah.
Like, but we can make little microcosms
of
influence.
I think capitalism will always be a thing, you know, especially in democracy, but even out of democratic nations, it'll still be a thing.
But capitalism,
there's ways we can mitigate the bad aspects of it, you know.
And it doesn't exist inside my house.
Right.
I spend so much little time thinking about money. You know, I check my bank account very little.
Yeah.
And like, I live okay, and like, it's getting stretchy recently because of the holidays and because of inflation recently.
Sure.
But I'll make adjustments, but I spend very little time thinking about money and finances, especially in my home and in my own life. You know, capitalism exists in its own corner where I, you know, manipulate things to get money. You know?
Yeah.
Like, in this instance, it'd be cooking. You know, like, we don't have to be capitalistic right here.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Like, but when
take your wins when you can, right?
Yeah. But I guess some people have to work it, I guess. I'm getting in circles too.
Yeah. All
right, pal. What advice would you give to somebody about living well? What would be your advice? This is how we're gonna end it.
What would be my advice? I guess, like, a lot of what you're saying, you know, to the best of your ability, you know, some, like myself, I don't think I've mastered that ability as much as, like, you, for example, but,
no,
you know.
Don't say that. That's not true.
No, but just, yeah, trying to be true to yourself and, you know, love yourself, but not only loving yourself, but having empathy for others, you know. I have a big thing about empathy, I guess, and I think if people were a little more empathetic, it could really change the world in the sense of everyone putting in just that little bit could really have some positive impacts, and I think everyone should do their part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like when it comes to the climate too, if everyone recycled one thing a day, it wouldn't even be as big of an issue as you know, it is nowadays. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, I definitely think that that's a big part of it, and just yeah, just trying to be happy, you know, be like you're saying, you know, it sounds like I was saying about cliches, it's so profound, but it's so simple, you know, just be happy, just try to live in the moment and be happy and not rush things. Life will find its way eventually, no matter what. You're gonna get older, no matter what, we're all going to die, but don't rush through things, you know, just
kind of a waste.
Just live, you know, live and be happy, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a song, isn't it? Live and be happy.
Or let it be.
Yeah.
Let it be
or something
else.
Like that. Yeah. So, yeah, because I definitely, you know, when I was younger, when I was like 15, all I wanted to do was move out and, you know, get away from like my parents and, you know, just be able to do whatever the hell I wanted. But now, you know, I'm a complete mama's boy now. I love my mom, and, you know, I do my best to try and be around her as much as I can, because I know how much she's done for me and how much she loves me. And, you know, we might not agree about everything all the time, but she does. You know, she's there for me, and she's always been there for me. And so, you know, that's another guilt aspect, too. And, you know, I like to think it's not a guilt, though. I love my mom, but... you know, these things are important, and I think when you're younger, you really don't understand the importance of these things. And, you know, as much as someone can tell you the importance of something, you know, as at least with me, I was the type where I still had to go find out for myself the hard way, whether that's don't do drugs or, you know, what, or being homeless sucks or, you know, what have you. And so... yeah, you don't want to find out for the hard way, and you get older and you come to find out that what these people were saying, the adults were saying was true, you know, but just not in the way that they described it,
mm-hmm.
but it ends up being true in a roundabout way, like all in the same way,
like a joke.
But differently, I guess. I don't know, I'm not explaining this
well. It approaches the exact same way a joke does.
Huh.
The same way a good joke does. It's always subtle. You don't expect it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, so just try to, you know, be in the moment and be with yourself and be happy and do what you can to have empathy for yourself, and that in turn should lead to more positivity outwards too. You know, try to be introspective, you know, look deep within yourself and find, you know, emotional intelligence, find, I guess something I need to work on is my, like, just, I wouldn't call it, I don't know, my own emotional intelligence as compared to others' emotion, being intelligent about others' emotions, you know, trying to, you know, just like I said, have empathy for people and, you know, put yourself in their shoes, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, is this a simpler way of putting it? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know, I just try to, anytime I'm sitting here thinking about something that perplexes me, or if I'm thinking about something else, I always try and put myself in their shoes, you know, and I think we need a lot more of that in this day and age, of putting oneself in another's shoes and trying to see it from their perspective.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, you think?
Thank you, man.
Yeah.
I appreciate you being here tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Wow. All right, everybody. You guys have a great evening. I'll be back next week. Bye.